Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's White House North American Leaders Summit, otherwise known as the Three Amigos Summit, and speak with the Mexico City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers, Tim Johnson. We will discuss the upcoming elections to succeed Mexico's lame duck President Calderon, and since Tim Johnson was recently McClatchy's Bureau Chief in Beijing and is the author of Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World but Lost the Battle with China, we will discuss the recent rash of self-immolations by Tibetans protesting Chinese rule. Then we will examine the elections in Burma that are being celebrated as an important step towards democracy, although the pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi's party won 40 seats in a parliament where the ruling military junta controls the vast majority of the 664 seats. Dr. Joseph Silverstein, a distinguished professor emeritus of political science at Rutgers University who has written extensively on Burma, joins us to assess the changes underway. Then finally, as the noose tightens on Iran's economy, we will look into political dissent inside Iran to determine whether tightened sanctions and economic distress will revive the green movement or turn the Iranian people against the West. Roya Hakakian, an Iranian-American poet and journalist, joins us. She has an article in the New York Times International Weekly, Where Did Iran's Green Movement Go? And joining us now is Tim Johnson, who is the Mexico City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. He worked for 14 years for the Miami Herald, covering U.S. policy towards Latin America, serving as a foreign correspondent for the Herald through most of the 1990s in Central America and the Andean region. Between 2003 and 2009, Tim Johnson was the Beijing Bureau Chief for Knight Ridder and McClatchy, and he's the author of Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World but Lost the Battle with China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tim Johnson.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And the North American Leaders Summit took place today at the White House, jokingly referred to as the Three Amigos Summit. But of course, the Mexican president is pretty much a lame duck. He's out of office in December. The Canadian Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, has recently been elected with a huge majority. And Barack Obama, of course, as we know, is up for re-election. What's the significance of this summit then, given the different political fortunes of the players involved?
Well, certainly the next summit, and we don't know exactly when that will have a very different complexion because of the likely return of the Institutional Revolutionary Party of Mexico, the party that ruled Mexico for 71 years. President Felipe Calderon used this summit today to make his case for several things. Among them, he's very eager for Mexico to join this Trans-Pacific Partnership on trade, and Canada wants to join as well. Obama made no promises in this regard, but Calderon is would like to have, as part of his legacy, the integration of Mexico into the sort of big leagues of world diplomacy. He's hosting the G20 summit in June in Mexico.
Well, apparently the three-way trade between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico now exceeds $1 trillion. So what would this new trade pact do for the three countries involved?
I don't know what the projections are, but as you said, it's $1 trillion a year already because of NAFTA. And if with this Trans-Pacific Partnership, it would be the largest trade agreement since NAFTA was signed in 1994.
But don't a lot of Mexicans, and certainly around the world, a lot of people on the left say that NAFTA and neoliberalism has been the death of so much in terms of small economies, rural cultures? NAFTA is not necessarily that popular amongst the average Mexicans, is it, surely? I'm sure it's popular with the multi-billionaire Carlos Slim, who's the richest man in the world in a very poor country.
Yes, it's hard to really argue the case for NAFTA, given the fact that monopolies and duopolies control so many sectors of the Mexican economy, you know, that you've got nearly half of Mexicans living at a poverty level and the world's richest man. So, you know, certainly inequality has gone hand in hand with NAFTA. Not to say that there haven't been some benefits, but it hasn't been something that was designed to foment small business, for sure.
Again, I'm speaking with Tim Johnson, who is the Mexico City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers, and he also, up until recently, was the Beijing Bureau Chief for Knight Ridder and McClatchy, and the author of Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World but Lost the Battle with China. Since you're an expert in both Mexico and China, and in particular Tibet, Tim, I'd like to segue after a bit into what's happening, this rash of self-immolations are going on in Tibet. But let's stick with Mexico and the Three Amigos summit for a bit more. The recent polls show that Peña Nieto, who is the Enrique Peña Nieto, is the pre-candidate running in Mexico's July presidential elections. He has a commanding lead over Calderón's successor with the National Action Party, PAN, Josefina Vázquez Mota. And apparently Andrés Manuel López Obrador, with the PRD, he's trailing in a distant third. Is that your understanding?
Yes, it's really hard to see at this point how any other candidate could catch up with Peña Nieto. He's, as you say, his lead is very commanding, and he's got a huge war chest for this compressed political campaign of 3 months. You know, with voters going to the polls on July 1st, it's hard to see how he's going to lose at this point.
So what happened to the change in the Mexican political zeitgeist, if you will? I mean, the PRI was it was like the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. It was very corrupt and basically sclerotic. And there was, I guess there was a lot of hope with Vicente Fox and his successor Calderon. But this war on drugs seemed to have worn the Mexican people down, not the least of which there's been 50,000 people have died since Calderon waged this war and brought the military, Mexican military in. And to most Mexicans, I guess it feels that, you know, Mexicans are dying for a war that's supposed to benefit America.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I think that is apparent to all in Mexico is that the level of excitement for any of these three candidates is pretty low. One reads commentary frequently that Mexicans don't have the kinds of candidates that they deserve, and one detects that in the lack of enthusiasm for any of them. Certainly the violence over the last 6 years that really began with Calderón's coming to office in late 2006 has been. It's a major issue. I don't want to downplay the economic issue because that's also it goes hand in hand. But one can't. It's hard not to look back and think how much of opportunity was wasted over these last dozen years since the PRI lost control to have real reforms that would open up the political system and level the playing field both economically and politically. The parties have an entire a grip on this process. Independent candidates have not been able to register to run in the election.
But explain that, Tim Johnson, again the bureau chief in Mexico City for McClatchy Newspapers. You would think that after the grip of the 71-year rule of the PRI party was broken, that the other parties, particularly the one that won the next presidency, the PAN, would have opened up the system radically, because it seems like now they're going back to the PRI. It's almost like, going back to the mafia. You know how crooked they are, but at least they're reliable, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's several factors. One is the demographic factor of how many Mexicans are young. And so 12 years is half a generation. And for an awful lot of Mexicans coming into of voting age, they don't recollect necessarily firsthand what had occurred, because the final years of the PRI were different than, say, two or three decades ago. So the PRI has really taken advantage of that to say, we're a different party. We're a younger party. We've learned. We're looking towards the future. You never hear any PRI propaganda saying we're going back to how it was, with a corporativist system. And so partly what has happened is that the PAN has realized that they can take advantage of some of these elements that the PRI the levers of power that they ruled on, such as the power of the teachers' union, the power of the petroleum workers' union, and try to harness it to their benefit, because it's up for grabs a bit now.
So the war on drugs obviously has worn people down. You mentioned the economic aspects. What is it to, I mean, I don't imagine the economy is any better than our economy. It's obviously going to, you know, be probably worse. I know that the joke about Vicente Fox was that he promised 10 million new jobs. The only problem was they were all in America. And now America's closed the door. So that's clearly created a lot of economic distress back home, hasn't it, in Mexico?
Yes, it has. I mean, there's still, you know, there's heavy emphasis on the assembly industry along the border. The auto industry is actually going very strongly, so strongly that Brazil is shutting the door on more Mexican auto imports, and Argentina wants to do the same thing. But, you know, this idea that Mexico's middle class is a strengthening sector, I'm still pretty skeptical. The people I come in contact with are not feeling that there's a lot of economic mobility yet, not this, of the sort that we're seeing in places like Peru and Brazil. It's just not happening. The growth rates are not such that there's just a general sense of things are getting better.
So do you think that there's any way to change the inevitability of the capturing the presidency? Is there any rabbit that Calderon can pull out of the hat at the last minute, like capturing El Chapo Guzman, the major drug lord?
I think there's no doubt that he's itching to be able to do that. Now, it's easier said than done. And in fact, maybe it'll happen after the election because, you know, the thing about Calderon is that as much as he would like his party to remain in power, he's more concerned about his personal safety and that of his family. And so actually a lot of what is happening is that Calderon is involved in a really internecine spat with his own party's candidate. And he's looking at his own legacy and how he's going to stay alive in the future and his family safe. And those are kind of daunting prospects for him. Does he remain in Mexico? What does he do?
Well, that's a pretty extraordinary indictment of a country. If its leader doesn't have any personal security after he leaves office, that is really a portrait of a lawless state. I mean, one of the assumptions about the PRI is because of their corrupt past that they will go back to the old arrangements they had with the drug cartels, which were, you know, you keep the violence down, but keep the money flowing.
And, you know, even if the PRI really has changed on a national level, and I would have some doubts about that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that on the regional state levels, the PRI governors are not involved in cahoots with organized crime. All indications are that, for instance, in Tamaulipas state, bordering Texas in the northeast of the country, there are three former PRI governors now who are under investigation. And one of them has left Mexico, curiously, to go find safety in the United States. So he apparently is in San Antonio. Now, word is that the U.S. Prosecutors are looking into his past as well. But it's, you know, the PRI on in the states, in the real heavy conflict areas, is very heavily tainted by that legacy of, you know, some sort of complicity with organized crime.
Well, no question, the Figueroas in Guerrero were a mafia family, you know, and there's been unbelievable bloodshed in Acapulco, these gang wars with heavy weaponry because the PID took over there. So let's change the topic a little if we can, Tim Johnson, since you have this unusual expertise of being both the Mexico City Bureau Chief, former Clatchy Newspapers, and between 2003 and 2009, you were the Beijing Bureau Chief for Knight Ridder and McClatchy, and you wrote the book Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World but Lost the Battle with China. And nothing is more poignant in the sense of a lost battle than what's happening with the Buddhists in Tibet. There have been a rash of self-immolations. Some of them have been unbelievably, you know, I suppose, I can't think of the word. I mean, one of the monks drank kerosene and then poured it over himself and lit himself, and then he exploded. And then the police rushed his body and pieces of his body off to a police station, and the Tibetans were furious and sacked the police station to get his body back. But none of this stuff is being covered particularly because the Chinese security is such a blanket that the pictures aren't getting out. And when you contrast what's happening in Tibet to the fact that a single fruit seller in Tunisia who lit himself on fire ignited the Arab Spring.
Well, you know, this is a tragedy, and so much of what is of these self-immolations have not been known about in the outside world very much. But the one that occurred last week in New Delhi was very important and dramatic because there were photographers on hand, and the pictures of that Tibetan aflame, you know, running along a road. Those were dramatic pictures, and I think they were published in newspapers all over the world. So I think that that kind of coverage can awaken people to this tragedy. There have been, as you said, 32 of these self-immolations in a little more than a year. They've covered, geographically, they've been in all areas of the Tibetan plateau, the Kham and the Amdo region, the Tibetan Autonomous Region, as China calls it, and now in India. You know, it's been men, it's monks and nuns and lay people, people of all ages, especially young people. And China has reacted to this with, you know, rather astounding declarations that this is a Nazi tactic ordered by the Dalai Lama, and that somehow he's ordered this, and nothing could be further from the truth. You can't order people to self-immolate, I don't think. This is a decision that is a sign of the depth of despair. The elected leader of the Tibetans, Lobsang Sangye, this a former Harvard law lecturer, is accusing China of trying to, quote, annihilate the Tibetan people. And I think this is probably a sentiment that Tibetans across the board would agree with.
Well, apparently in the culture, particularly, you know, the last two that we set on fire were 21 and a 22-year-old monks, Buddhist monks, on Friday. It's a sign of selflessness and nobility, because you die, but it's not like a suicide bomber who takes out a bunch of people around him. It's a powerful message, but the Chinese seem to be fairly callous. And I believe the average in the Chinese public, they have little sympathy for Tibetans. They seem to think that Tibetans are a bunch of ungrateful freeloaders.
Yeah, and also, though, I'm sure the Chinese leaders are watching this extremely carefully, and the symptom of that is the kind of repression that's occurring across the Tibetan plateau right now. And we're in the run up to a transition of leadership in China, so they don't, you know, this is a black eye to them, and so they are watching it very carefully and very concerned about the international image that this creates.
Well, just in closing, Tim Johnson, will this tragedy of Tibet ever get resolved? Is this simply, when you mentioned earlier the anxiety that Tibetans, particularly the Harvard professor you mentioned, or Harvard lecturer that you mentioned, that essentially cultural genocide is taking place? That's my understanding, that the Chinese are literally just moving in. They bought that railroad up there. They're trying to resettle Han Chinese. They seem to be just, it seems to be a sort of form of cultural genocide that's being implemented.
Well, you know, my impression is that the only real hope for Tibetans at this point is what some people would call a Hail Mary pass. There would be some sort of catalytic event affecting the party's control in China. And just as the Timorese were able to take advantage of Indonesian upheaval to, you know, sort of force a UN referendum, then the Tibetans would hope that, you know, there might be a similar opportunity for them in a period of chaos in which they could somehow, win or negotiate a real measure of autonomy. As the phrase a Hail Mary pass indicates, this is it's a threading a needle. It's not an easy thing. A lot of factors have to come together. So that's why it's really a sort of a desperation tactic.
Well, it's the problem with that is the pictures aren't getting out, as opposed to the Tunisian fruit seller who set himself on fire and started that and ignited the Arab Spring. The Chinese, the more that these self-immolations take place in Tibet, the more the Chinese security blanket comes down, and they already have an enormous security blanket. Western reporters can't get in. It's a bit like Syria.
Yes, it's very, very difficult. And even if they were able to get in and broadcast these images outside of China, the Chinese people wouldn't necessarily see them at all.
Well, and if they did see them, apparently they're not that sympathetic. That's the part of it that's extraordinary.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, they've been taught for decades now that the Tibetans are ungrateful for all that China has done in terms of massive amounts of development assistance. Of course, the Tibetans have not had a say in how this money is spent, or if they want to be developed the way that the Han Chinese that's been imposed upon them.
So, is there any sympathy for Tibet within China, among leading intellectuals, or even perhaps even in the political class? I mean, obviously there have been signs recently of, something going on at the highest level in terms of a shuffle in the Politburo and the arrest of a high-ranking politician. Is there any indications that there's any liberalism, if you will, on the part of in the Chinese leadership, or is it all basically this hardline?
I don't know about within the leadership itself, but there's certainly an appeal of Tibetan Buddhism in a certain sector of the intelligentsia and academia, but it's dangerous to express. It's dangerous to measure. But I had a sense of it firsthand because I went to a very remote Buddhist community in northern Sichuan province called Sertar for one chapter of my book, and I ran into a number of Han Chinese, many of them. I remember speaking to one woman who had a PhD and had given up her career to go study Tibetan Buddhism. There were at least 100, if not more, there, and they said, look, there's a lot of interest in Tibetan Buddhism among Han Chinese. It's not easy for us to come and study.
Well, Tim Johnson, I thank you for joining us here today, covering both Mexico and the summit in the White House of the Mexican leader, along with the Canadian leader and President Obama, and being able to touch on this hideous tragedies going on inside of Tibet.
Ian, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Tim Johnson, who is the Mexico City Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. He worked for 14 years for the Miami Herald, covering U.S. policy towards Latin America, serving as a foreign correspondent for the Herald through most of the 1990s in Central America and the Andean region. And between 2003 and 2009, Tim Johnson was the Beijing Bureau Chief for Knight Ridder and McClatchy. He is the author of Tragedy in Crimson, How the Dalai Lama Conquered the World but Lost the Battle with China. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment talking about democracy blossoming in Burma.
(音乐)